I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. It's my great joy today to welcome to Conversing as our guest, Justin Gibney. Justin is an attorney, lives in Atlanta, has done a lot of writing, and it's one of his books that we're going to be looking at today, entitled Compassion and Conviction, which was co-authored by Michael Ware and also Chris Butler, with a foreword by Barbara Williams Skinner. I mentioned the foreword in part because Barbara is a longtime friend of Fuller Seminary's, having been on the board, and she and her former husband having had such an impact at Fuller in so many different ways. So, Justin, welcome. I'm so glad that you're with us today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Labberton. I'm just glad to be here, glad to be having this conversation.
So much of what we want to go on and talk about in your book, Compassion and Conviction, has to do with Christian faith. So let's just start there. Just give us a little glimpse of your context so that as we take this forward, we'll have an opportunity to understand more about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, my faith in particular?
Yes.
My faith walk? Yeah. I mean, I'm somebody who was raised in the church. I'm the son of a preacher's kid. And so was always in the church and went off to college and kind of moved away from the church a little bit. I wasn't as focused on my faith as I should have been. And that lasted probably after I got out of law school and even into the profession. And then, you know, at some point I started to look into politics and say, the way that I'm doing politics, there's something missing here. I began to really focus on the intersection between faith and politics. How should we apply our values to the issues of the day? Is there really this separation between what we really believe and what we believe in the public square? What does that look like? And I began to see that that was a question that a lot of Christians had.
Right, right. Well, it's an amazing convergence, and it obviously leads you eventually to start the AND campaign. So for some of our listeners, undoubtedly, they're very well acquainted with the AND campaign, but it is probably the fullest expression of this intersection that you're describing and the way that you're trying to lead and manifest that. So explain a bit about the AND campaign, and then we'll come to the book.
Yeah, sure. So the AND campaign is a Christian civic organization that's trying to help Christians apply their values to the issues of the day. So we're trying to raise civic literacy. We want Christians to understand politics better. But we're also trying to let Christians know that as you engage politics, you should do so more so from a framework of Christian principles than from a progressive ideological framework or a conservative ideological framework. That even ideological conservatism is different than theological conservatism in a lot of ways. It's going to come to different conclusions. And so part of what that means and what we try to help people do is it means you have to reframe the issues. Unfortunately, we live in a society where there's kind of like a false dichotomy, where you're really told if you care about social justice, then you got to go to the left. If you care about righteousness and moral order, then you're going to go to the right. And so I found, especially younger Christians are really conflicted, as they should be, with that choice because it's a false dilemma. When you look at the Bible and you even read Ephesians 4:15, Paul tells the church of Ephesus that we should always be able to speak the truth in love, right? And so we see that the gospel, and even as we look at Jesus and his ministry, the gospel is about love and truth. It's not just about one. And in fact, if you're missing one, then you're missing the gospel. Those two things go together. And, you know, that's not just for our personal interactions, but that's how we engage the public square. We got to be thinking about love and truth, justice and moral order, compassion and conviction. And so that's the framework that the AND campaign kind of works from in helping Christians distance themselves and distance their identity to a certain extent from their party and from their ideology and really more so embrace Christian principles.
Let's just pause a little bit longer on this issue of AND. Why do you think it is fundamentally that we have come to a place where the dominant cultural paradigm is either or and not and? What's behind the drivenness to this kind of polarization? And where does the instinct for and for you really arise? Because that's a very, very countercultural thing based on the current stage of our American debates.
I think generally this comes from the world has trouble holding the tension between love and truth. We have trouble understanding that, yes, we can love somebody, but they may also need to be corrected and we may also disagree with them. And yes, we can tell people the truth, but we also need to have compassion. So I think generally the gospel helps us articulate that. The gospel demonstrates that. But when you're in the world and you're not focused on how those two things come together, it's hard to hold the tension because they just don't seem to go together. They seem to almost be in conflict. And so if you even put it, bring down to the party level, or ideological level, we have one side that says it represents love and compassion, another side that seems to focus more so on moral order and the righteousness side of it. That becomes even more so polarized when you put politics on top of it, right? When you put different people's interests, you have all these interest groups, and now you have cable news and talk radio that really just pull each other apart, right? That the way that social media is set up, the way that the internet is set up, it's all confirmation bias. We only have to listen to the people who say what we want them to say. If I hear Dr. Labberton say something that I disagree with, I can Google another answer and say, hey, this is actually the answer I want to hear. And right. so our right. ears are always being tickled and we don't really have to engage in a conversation.
Right, right. Exactly. Well, I do think, as I have been observing, like you have, this polarization, it's arising or it's claiming to arise in some cases, especially from the conservative side. It's claiming to arise from a kind of plumb line vision that says God is really setting a plumb line and you're either in or you're out, you're right or you're wrong. And the fact that that's then being driven through all of the issues of the day seems so lacking in the counterbalance to that, which also has to be held in tension. Mm-hmm. So I keep wondering, what is it that we've been doing in our churches? What is it that has been done theologically? What is it that's done ideologically and culturally that makes either or seem so much more, quote, faithful to the people who choose that? Because it is, as you say, really actually an either or that exists on the left and on the right. The left can be as much either or as the right can be either or, right? Yeah. And it seems to me that has something to do with a failure to have a sufficient vision of who God actually is. We think of him as this line drawer who's always separating, as opposed to a God who, as it says in Colossians, literally is the one who in Jesus Christ holds all things together. That's a very, very different theological vision, which doesn't really seem to be the moment, obviously, that we're living in.
Yeah, I found that we tend to kind of dumb things down so that we can understand it. And when we dumb things down, everything becomes kind of like this binary. And I think people don't want to be lukewarm.
Yes.
Right. And so they say, hey, either you're all in or you're all out. Well, you don't want to be lukewarm on some things. And we know that from the Bible. But when you base those lines on ideological lines, when you base it on partisan lines, then you run into trouble because you remove the nuance from very important conversations. A lot of the mistakes that we make in the public square is that because we kind of remove part of the reality from an entire conversation. So I think in trying to dumb it down so we can feel comfortable with it and avoid the tension, a lot of Christian life is just living in a tension, living in the tension of love and truth, living in the tension of a father who is liberating, right? Who wants to liberate you, but also is asking you to be obedient. It's easier to jump to one side of that and go all in with either the obedience or go all in with the liberation and not deal with how those both come into tension. It just makes for an easier narrative to explain. It makes for stronger talking points, stronger bumper stickers. And so I think that's why we choose one side of the tension instead of embracing something that may be a little more nuanced, but better represents who God is. So it's not a matter of never choosing a side. It's making sure that when you choose a side, it's not just based on ideological lines. It's based on the love and truth of the gospel.
Right. It reminds me of that moment in the Garden of Eden when the tempter says, did God say to you, you should not eat of any tree in the garden? And it forces in that narrative the picture of this either or choice. And it's a false dichotomy, as you say, but it's one that obviously ensnares human beings everywhere all the time. So part of the Christian vocation that you're underscoring, and I completely concur, is this both and posture. Now, pressing on with that just a little bit more, sometimes when people hear that, what they think is, oh, you're going to find some antiseptic middle that isn't either this or that. It's just this spot in the middle that's about balance. But what I hear you arguing in your book and saying now is something much more vigorous than that, that has to do with how do you hold on to more than one narrative? Like Chimamanda Adichie says in her very, very popular TED Talk, the danger of the single story. It's dangerous to hold on to one story. And somehow, I think what I'm hearing you say and what your book, I think, indicates is that you and the AND campaign are making the case that faithfulness equals holding on to what are genuinely conflicting realities, or so they are our experience. And then how do we hold on to both of those and move forward, as opposed to cutting it and choosing simply one side or the other?
Yeah, it's not about just finding a squishy middle, because a lot of people, what they do is that you see the error in conservatism, you see the error in progressivism. I'm just not going to make a choice. So it's not about saying, hey, don't take a side on a very serious issue. It's about saying when you take a side on the issue, make sure that side isn't framed through progressivism or conservatism. And that's what I think people mix up about what the AND campaign is saying. When it comes to criminal justice, I'm going to take a side. I'm going to be very clear on what that looks like. But the side that I take and how I articulate that isn't going to necessarily be framed through a progressive frame, right?
Right.
And that's the difference that we really want to point out, to say the Bible holds these things in tension better than any ideology could.
Right.
So just because I'm not going along with progressivism doesn't mean I'm going along with conservatism either. And that's what people don't get. It's one choice or the other. And you must be embracing the other if you're not embracing the one that I like. But what I try to tell Christians is, do you realize how much you're giving up as a Christian to frame every issue in a conservative way or a progressive way? You're giving up so much, and you're limiting your witness in a way that is just not healthy. And so I think we just need to think a little bit harder, keep reading the Bible, and understand that you can order something that's not on the menu. It doesn't mean that you're not taking a side, but you're doing it in a better way. Another way that I put it is, if I don't agree with something that's progressive or conservative, it's not saying that the other side is better. It's just saying that there's a better way to address it than both of those, right? And that's what I think people need to, for one, not be so intellectually lazy in how we address this, because it can be very easy just falling one side or the other, but really think it through and apply what Jesus is saying to what we're going through today.
Right. So let me use an example and see how you would play this out. One of the things that we know is the subject of a lot of skepticism and anger and division has to do with whether the problems that we're facing are, quote, systemic, or whether they're personal. Now, that becomes its own false dichotomy, but it falls out pretty much cleanly along ideological lines, that it's either about personal problems or it's about systemic problems. And the people who are on the personal side really think that systemic talk is even deceptive and wrong and overreaching and misstated. And people on the systemic side feel like it's reductionist to think that it's all about the individual and not about the system. So talk us through that as an example of what we've just been discussing about AND.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that that's the false dichotomy between systems and people is that they're not mutually exclusive.
Right.
It's people who create systems, right? And the systems impact people who, you know, and it just kind of perpetuates, right? So
right.
We have to understand, let's take racism, right? When we talk about racism, yes, I think you can say that it starts off as a personal issue. But when that person who's racist in their heart and who has these issues becomes the governor of Alabama, right? And can use those biases that he has to actually make policy, then it becomes a systemic issue. The other thing is, we have to understand when it comes to race in this systemic versus personal conversation, is that it's just absurd to argue that we could have discrimination written in our laws for longer than it's been out of the laws, almost two or three times longer than it's been out of the laws, but it somehow evaporates once it's no longer in the law. That just doesn't, we don't say that with anything else. In fact, when we talk about the spirit of America, we talk about a spirit that goes back to the revolution. Well, if we still have that spirit and the American dream can carry through on all that time, why wouldn't the negative stuff be able to carry through as well? And so these are just conversations we have to have. People do have race issues, and they can affect people on a personal level, and they can also put it into systems. And so it can be both. And the fact of the matter that it is, if we look hard enough, we'll see it.
Right. Well, again, it's this instinct that feels like a virus. Truly, even the most benign way of representing it is a virus. It feels much worse than that, but certainly a virus that is driven toward this separation, and it's either this or it's that. And I think that there is a portrait of Christianity that has been a cheapened gospel that has been being promoted for a long time that really suggests, I think, in the name of a sort of Reformation principle that we're saved by grace alone. And it suggests, therefore, there's nothing for us to do. God has really done it, and we're completely on easy street. as opposed to understanding that the call to be a disciple is a call to complexity. It's a call to engagement. It's a call to both and not either or. And it is a call to also make hard decisions when you must fall on one side or another in expressing your response to a particular concern. We have not allowed the gospel to be sufficiently rich. We've done a very bad job, I think, often in preaching that portrays it really as a reductionist vision of the gospel. What would be examples to you when you think about the ministry of Jesus complexifying reality rather than reducing it along these lines that we're talking about? Are there examples that stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of examples. I mean, there's so many times when he's asked a question and he reframes the question. Well, do we pay our taxes or do we not engage? And he's like, I'm not going to answer that question the way you asked it, because number one, it would ensnare me and you're trying to push me in a different direction. But it's more complicated than that. You can actually, in a way, do both. And it's about the orientation of your heart and how that manifests through what you're doing that really matters. It's not just about the act of giving something to Caesar. Hey, that's his. Let him have it. But how much are you giving to Caesar?
Yeah.
And I think Jesus shows us over and over again that the gospel will not be used just for our platforms or for our purposes. It never allows itself to fit any of that stuff perfectly. And when we try to do that, and we've seen it happen over and over again, we go way afoul of where the gospel is trying to push us, whether it was, you know, with the moral majority or others. When you try to fit the gospel into kind of like a political platform or some other type of agenda, it's just not going to go with that, because it's not going to go perfectly with our interests. It's always going to conflict with what we want in some way or another. And that's the beauty of it. It keeps us honest and it keeps us vigilant, because you never completely get it perfect.
Right. That's all part of why I always say that we should never be more than 5 minutes from reading the gospel, because it feels like we're just so easily prone to wander off rather than do that. Justin, what would be an example of an area where you find and a particularly challenging thing?
You know, I think one of the places that it comes up the most, especially in conversations with young people, is just LGBTQ conversations, where the framework that we have in America today and really Western culture is either you completely affirm something or you hate it. And that's it. Those are your only two choices, because this is so closely ingrained in somebody's identity and who they are that those are the only choices. Otherwise, you're committing violence, either directly or indirectly. And it's tough, because the church has gotten this wrong for so long. It does become hard to make an argument to defend that. So what I do is I don't try to defend the mistakes that the church has made. I ask the church to repent and to admit those mistakes. But still, you got to maintain what's right and wrong. And so what we try to do is say, okay, let's step away from this dichotomy of completely affirming something or completely hating, which we never really do that in our personal relationships, right? That's just not how things work. And say, how can I love somebody even if there's disagreement? How can I protect somebody even if there's disagreement on certain things? That's the only way we can carry on as human beings who are in a pluralistic society, who have very serious disagreements. And I think that's what we miss. The idea of living a pluralistic society and even loving your neighbor is not just for the easy times. It's not just for when they agree with something that you really, really hold dear. It's for when they don't agree, right? Like, this is when it really matters to love someone and to care about them, when you really don't agree with them and you think they're completely wrong. And you may even think that what you think could hurt me. Well, that's when that really matters. And I think we just need to apply it in a better way. And that's where I think our framework is very helpful, the love and truth and how those come together. It's that tension. And you can't get too comfortable in that tension, because you will fall to one side or the other. How do you maintain the tension of love and truth? And it's something that we, again, have to be vigilant about and really committed to on a daily basis.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. It was interesting to me, this was not an LGBT-related conversation, but a couple of years ago, I was in a conversation with a young adult, and we were discussing something else, and I said, you know, I really do love you, but I disagree with you completely in this particular issue that we were debating. And they stopped, and they said, wait, that can't be possible. I said, oh, it not only can be possible, it is actually frequently possible. In fact, you do it all the time. I do it all the time. You're just not aware that you're doing it. You're not thinking of it in these terms. We spent a long time discussing the evidences of that already in his life, but somehow in this one particular area, it felt like it really was, again, an either or. I either had to say I'm in complete agreement with him, and then I can say I love him. Or if I say that I disagree with him, then that just meant by definition that the conversation was at an end, and potentially the relationship was at an end. So I think what you're getting at, again, is not only theoretically important, but relationally vital to be able to practice these things and to exercise the muscles to develop the capacity in love and truth to stand together. This is a good entree, I think, to the chapter in your book, Compassion and Conviction, which is really called Compassion and Conviction, Civil Engagement Through a Biblical Framework. Now, we've hinted at the themes of this chapter based already on what you've said, but take it a little further. Let's use compassion and conviction as an example of this tension that needs to be maintained. Just tease that out a little bit fuller, and then I have a couple of questions I want to ask.
We talked about this false dichotomy, how society kind of pushes you into this compassion that just becomes sentimentalism, right? That it's a love that has no form. And if you look at the biblical concept of love, if you go to 1 John 3 and you go to other places, you go to the gospel, you see that love has form. Love is not something that's whatever we make it, because society makes it whatever we take it and do with it what we want. The Bible puts kind of a frame around it so that it really means something, right? So that it's greater than just this squishy thing that we can apply just to show some type of sentiment. But how do we connect that with the conviction, right? The truth, the principles that we hold dear that are timeless, right? How do we hold timeless convictions and care and be so caring, knowing that situations bring people into things that they didn't necessarily even choose, right? So how do we love people and kind of uphold the truth? That's really what we're trying to get at. And one of the ways that we talk about this is in the conversation of justice. So when we talk about justice, we say, look, a lot of the root of a side of justice is compassion. It's saying to somebody, because you are made in the image of God, you have a certain worth, you have a certain dignity. Therefore, you must be treated a certain way. And when God's people weren't treating others a certain way, this is when you see Isaiah, this is when you see Amos, this is when you see Micah saying, not only are you worshiping idols or you're doing this other immoral stuff, no, you have partiality in your courts. You know, you're not treating the poor properly.
Right.
These things were covenant lawsuits, just like all the other stuff that we more so talk about in certain spaces. And so you have that justice and the importance of that justice. But then we have to understand, when you come to the progressive side of it, if you don't have absolute truth, then you don't really have justice. When I tell somebody that you have to do justice, what am I saying? I'm saying that there's a standard that's unconditional, that it doesn't matter what your culture thinks, that it doesn't matter the time period. You have to apply that to everybody, whether you believe it or not. Well, at that point, it's not just about what I think. There's something that's outside of me that stands regardless. And so even in the justice conversation, you got to have the love, because you got to care about people and see their human dignity. But you got to have the absolute truth, or else you can't go to the white supremacist and say they have to do anything. Because if we're just using logic, then we can say, well, actually, it is in my interest and it's very logical for me to take from these people because there's only so many resources and they got it. Why wouldn't I take it? Well, that's logical, but it's not moral, right? It's not the right thing to do. And so that's what we mean when we try to hold those things in tension.
Yeah. It's just so interesting how often these things, as you know, because this is the backbone of the principal argument of the AND campaign, is that this tendency toward false dichotomies is so real. So if you take a Christian position, that becomes automatically, in many cases, a bigoted position by definition, right? And we live in a pluralist culture. So let's add pluralism to the conversation. You're wanting to hold on to compassion and conviction. You're standing on the confidence of God's eternal revelation. You're also being compassionate toward the people or persons that are before you at any given time. And now inside that world of public debate is a set of pluralist claims. We don't have any absolute access to any kind of truth. What we do is just really have our own truth. And my own truth becomes the way that you must allow me to occupy my truth and my space in light of what I understand to be true. So for you to make a claim of truth that preempts my truth is judged by pluralism to be automatically in error. So how does all that figure into this? Because that's a very complicating part of the social milieu of the moment.
Yeah, so you have someone that comes to the table and says, hey, if you're truly compassionate, if you truly care, you can't go against my truth.
Right.
And one of the ways that I talk about truth is that, number one, it's not objective. Everyone doesn't have their own truth. Now, you might have your own experiences and how you've interpreted them, but there's one truth. And one way that we can think about it is, and I've said this before, is think about truth like a Picasso. right? A Picasso or a masterpiece, you can't really improve upon it, right? You can't improve a Picasso. You can only deface a Picasso. So no matter how great of an artist I am, if I go up to it with a paintbrush or whatever I have, and I do anything to it, I've defaced it. I've ruined it. I've made it worse, right? So if my truth and what I say goes against what is real, then that's problematic. And the only way that I can uphold what's real to you and defend it is if it's more than just something to you. If truth is just subjective and you make of it what you want to make of it, then there's no way to defend it. There's no way for me to defend you and tell this other person over there that might isn't right. Because if they say, well, might is right, and I said it, and you don't care about me unless I say that, well, you can say whatever you want up until the point that it violates somebody else's human dignity.
Right.
And so when your truth violates somebody's human dignity, at that point in a pluralistic society, that's when you say you've gone too far. Now, in a personal conversation, when you're doing something that I think is not true that hurts you, I might not make a law against it, but I still, as a Christian, need to say that's not what God wants for you. And that's the difference. But loving somebody has nothing to do with you agreeing with them, because we've all been in situations ourselves where we've thought things and then our opinions changed. If your opinion can change on something and that was your truth, then what value does truth have? There's been so many instances where I wanted to do something or I was thinking something and my parents said, that's a bad idea. And if they would have not said that to me because they didn't think that would be loving me to tell me I was wrong, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. Right? So love is also correction. You know, it can also come in different ways. And for truth to mean anything, it has to be more than just your truth. I want to defend what's true for you, but in order to do that, it has to be bigger than you.
So the AND campaign is going on right now. What would be an example of a project that you're currently working on? Show us how this translates into some particular actions, which I know you and the AND campaign are up to.
We have the Prayer and Action Justice Initiative, which is kind of playing on the idea that some people say, well, just pray about it. And some people say, no, act. We're saying, no, do both. Again, and we're going to pray because that is important. And we're dealing with things that are more than just what we see in this world. But we're also going to act, just like we see throughout the Old Testament and other places where God tells us to do certain things. Because when we pray and when he tries to heal things, he often does that through us. And so we're not going to use prayer as an excuse not to get out there and be active. And so what we're trying to do with the Prayer and Action Justice Initiative is we have some of the largest Black denominations. We have the National Association of Evangelicals, a bunch of evangelicals. Associations, the Asian American Christian Collaborative, all coming together to say, this is what the Bible says about justice. There's this debate about whether the Bible really wants us to gauge injustice. We want to shut that down and say, based on a biblical framework, this is what the Bible has to say about justice, which compels us to act. It doesn't save us. Me going out there and advocating for juvenile probation reform doesn't save me, but it is indicative of what's written on my heart. And so we want to take all these biblical groups of Christians who normally don't work together, who can't get together when it comes to partisan stuff. We want to say, no, let's throw party out of it. We're Christians. This is what the Bible said. Let's engage. So we have a really strong coalition for the Prayer and Action Justice Initiative. The first thing that we're going to be talking about is juvenile probation reform. So we're working for the Center for Public Justice and Prison Fellowship and many other organizations to say, how can we reform juvenile probation so that it actually helps these kids and doesn't mirror the adult version in a way that's just not helpful for young people? And we think we're going to really make some change around the nation. But again, it's putting our faith into action.
Yes.
Because we do care about our nation.
Right, right. Well, I think that we're in a period where the church in the United States, and frankly, in many places around the world, is in one of its most serious periods of crisis, I think, for a long, long time. And so much of it seems to me to be represented and reflected in the work that you're doing and in this AND effort, because without somehow tackling that issue and then working it through on the ground in certain applied areas like juvenile detention, that there's a disconnect, a radical disconnect between the integrity of the gospel and the language of faith, which then becomes a tool of weaponry of the right or the left. And that seems to me to be completely missing in the ministry of Jesus. So if you were going to take what you're doing in this effort, for example, and then imagine what it would require for the church in America itself to understand and operate in this AND-like way, and if you were able to do whatever you needed to do to accomplish this, what do you think are some of the two or three most important things that need to be done in congregations to stimulate this kind of an understanding?
There has to be a reckoning with America's history on race. Too often we romanticize our history because we don't want to deal with the fact that we may have some exceptional achievements, but also some exceptional transgression. We've done some things that are really bad, and we don't want to deal with that because it doesn't go along with the narrative.
Right.
And until we can have a conversation, a real conversation about American history, and do so with a spirit of self-examination rather than a posture of self-defense, it's going to be hard to have that. If you're trying to come into a conversation about race and you're trying to leave that conversation faultless, it's just not going to happen. But what I think we need to recognize is that almost any time that somebody had a conversation with Jesus, rarely did they leave with their narrative intact. And so us trying to keep our narratives intact is pride. We have to have a reckoning about those conversations and be real and realize that justice often demands a conflict with self-interest.
Right.
And if we want to get deep into why I believe a majority of evangelical churches don't really want to get deep into justice, because there's this conflict with self-interest that they don't want to engage. So it's easier to talk about critical race theory and find all these red herrings because you just don't want to do what it takes to be faithful in the public square. And until we're willing to do that and say, hey, I'm willing to say, I've got to give this to God and do what's right, whether it has an impact on me or not, we're not going to get there. But I'm thankful that I do see a lot of Christians, not as many as I would want, and there's still a lot more work to do, going on that journey, having honest conversations where we talk to each other in grace. And I think we have to remember, too, God always asks both sides for things. Even when the Hebrews were liberated, he didn't say, go off and do what you want to do. The world is yours. No, he chastised them and he was getting them. There's nobody in this race conversation that just gets to walk around pointing fingers. There's some real truths that need to be shared, but God's asking something of all of us. So we need to be gracious. We need to be willing to examine ourselves in order to move forward. But I think that history piece is one of the hardest things to get past because people feel like they're losing a piece of themselves to admit that what we haven't gotten right.
Right, right. Yeah. I think it's just such a profound point, Justin. When I was being interviewed to be president of Fuller and the board was asking me questions like, what do I think will be the main issues that would face me at the time of beginning as president if I was chosen? And I said, well, I think that there are some obvious issues that we might point to, but I think the primary underlying issue is the history of race and its intertwined racist history in America that's tied to so many things. And until we really face that issue and do all we can to try to address it, we can't make forward movement without doing that kind of historical work. I think some dominant culture people tend to think then that what that means is that just continuing to enter into endless self-critique and endless battering. Why is it not that? Does it ever have an end if you do that kind of accounting? Is there actually any horizon when there's ever going to be a possibility of that being lifted this side of eternity?
Yeah, if it's just about finger pointing and vengeance, then it never ends. And there are some folks who make it that way, that it's hard to tell if they want to heal, if they want to have some conciliation, or do they just want to, you know, keep poking and keep hitting because they're hurt.
Yeah, right.
I'm hurt. I want to hurt you. And I've had a lot of situations in life where I've been hurt. My parents have been hurt. You know, people in my community have been hurt.
Right.
But that's where the gospel steps in. That's where the gospel says, and where you see it in the civil rights movement in a profound way, that I have to love you through that. And I'm not here to make you wallow in shame.
Right.
I'm not here for you to hang your head and think that you can never recover. And I think sometimes on the left, we miss that too. I'm not asking you to embrace every part of my culture, all this stuff. I'm just asking you to do what's right and recognize what's been done wrong and how that still lingers. And we do need to be clear about that. We have to give people true opportunities to walk in the right direction. Give people a chance. And that's where we have to watch being so focused on language. And you say one wrong thing, now the conversation is over. God, we can't heal like that. We have to have a certain level of grace for people who are entering into this conversation. And that means listening in and listening to people who say the wrong thing sometimes, but trying to find the orientation of their heart.
Right.
And say, okay, this person's really trying. Let's move forward together. It's not going to be easy on anybody in the conversation.
Right, right. I do think that's part of what happened last summer with all the protests in response to George Floyd and the other killings was this, especially because of COVID, this kind of private curated world, which sometimes did nothing but polarize, but in some cases that have obviously made it to the press and in my own conversations with people, it's also allowed space for a quiet personal awakening. Like they finally have sat down and read more books or watched more videos or had more opportunity to really engage and sustain conversation about this. And it's been quite amazing to me, hardly like a huge groundswell, which I would hope and pray that it would be, but I'm at least heartened by some of the evidences that I'm seeing that people who thought they really had this kind of in hand have actually come to understand that it's a much deeper, longer, and personal issue. So I'm hopeful. What would be one thing that you find most hopeful right now? Here we are at the time that we're recording this. It's Holy Week. We're going to be celebrating Christ's death and resurrection. What is the hope that you see? What's an example of the hope that you see?
Yeah, one of the things that really gives me hope is just some of the people that I see God raising up. So whether it's Dr. Charlie Dates, Dr. Esau McCauley, Dr. Russell Moore, Lisa Fields, Jackie Hill Perry, people who can talk to different audiences, but always are going to stand 10 toes down on scripture, are always going to try to be compassionate and convictional. And there's so many of those folks being raised up. That just gives me hope. And to be in communication and friends with these folks and in community with them, it's really helpful. So there are a lot of folks who are trying to do this right.
Right.
Not as many as we would want, but they're out there and they're determined.
Right.
And God has anointed them just for this moment.
Yeah, I totally see it that way too. It's an amazing raising up of people. So I'm heartened by those same people and you. Justin, thank you so much for this conversation. I'm just really, really grateful to be able to share your story and to encourage people to not only follow the AND campaign, but to read this book, Compassion and Conviction. It's really a tremendously stimulating book, and I think very, very helpful to the kinds of issues that we've tried to explore a bit today. So thank you again very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.